Mary and Elizabeth, but it'll be manifest from what's been said that when at last James Stuart made his open claim to autocracy, the English merchants, peers, and private gentlemen found themselves with a tried and honoured traditional means of resisting him, such as no other people in Europe possessed. Another peculiarity of the English political conflict was its comparative detachment from the great struggle between Catholic and Protestant that was now being waged all over Europe. There were, it's true, very distinct religious issues mixed up in the English struggle, but upon its main lines it was a political struggle of king against the Parliament, embodying the class of private property-owning citizens. Both crown and people were formally reformed and Protestant. It's true that many people on the latter side were Protestants of a Bible-respecting, non-sacerdotal type, representing the Reformation according to the peoples, and that the king was the nominal head of a special sacerdotal and sacramental church, the established Church of England, representing the Reformation according to the princes. But this antagonism never completely obscured the essentials of the conflict. The struggle of king and parliament had already reached an acute phase before the death of James I in 1625, but only in the reign of his son, Charles I, did it culminate in civil war. Charles did exactly what one might have expected a king to do in such a position, in view of the lack of parliamentary control over foreign policy. He embroiled the country in a conflict with both Spain and France, and then came to the country for supplies in the hope that patriotic feeling would override the normal dislike to giving him money. When Parliament refused supplies, he demanded loans from various subjects and attempted similar illegal exaction. This produced from Parliament in 1628 a very memorable document, the Petition of Right, citing the Great Charter and rehearsing the legal limitations upon the power of the English king, denying his right to levy charges upon, or to imprison or punish anyone, or to quarter soldiers on the people without due process of law. The Petition of Right stated the case of the English Parliament. The disposition to state a case has always been a very marked English characteristic. When President Wilson, during the Great War of 1914-18, prefaced each step in his policy by a note, he was walking in the most respectable traditions of the English. Charles dealt with this Parliament with a high hand. He dismissed it in 1629, and for 11 years he summoned no parliament. He levied money illegally, but not enough for his purpose, and realizing that the church could be used as an instrument of obedience, he made Laud, an aggressive high churchman, very much of a priest, and a very strong believer in divine right, Archbishop of Canterbury, and so head of the Church of England. In 1638, Charles tried to extend the half-Protestant, half-Catholic characteristics of the Church of England to his other kingdom of Scotland, where the secession from Catholicism had been more complete, and where a non-sacerdotal, non-sacramental form of Christianity, Presbyterianism, had been established as the national church. The Scotch revolted, and the English levies Charles raised to fight them mutinied. Insolvency, at all times the natural result of a spirited foreign policy, was close at hand. Charles, without money or trustworthy troops, had to summon a parliament at last in 1640. This parliament, the short parliament, he dismissed in the same year. He tried a council of peers at York in 1640, and then, in the November of that year, summoned his last parliament. This body, the Long Parliament, assembled in the mood for conflict. It seized Laud, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and charged him with treason. It published a grand remonstrance, which was a long and full statement of its case against Charles. It provided by a bill for a meeting of Parliament at least once in 3 years, whether the King summoned it or no. It prosecuted the king's chief ministers who had helped him to reign for so long without Parliament, and in particular the Earl of Strafford. To save Strafford, the king plotted for a sudden seizure of London by the army. This was discovered, and the bill for Strafford's condemnation was hurried on in the midst of a vast popular excitement. Charles I, who was probably one of the meanest and most treacherous occupants the English throne has ever known, was frightened by the London crowds. Before Strafford could die by due legal process, it was necessary for the king to give his assent. Charles gave it, and Strafford was beheaded. Meanwhile, the king was plotting and looking for help in strange quarters, from the Catholic Irish, from treasonable Scotchmen. Finally, he resorted to a forcible, feeble display of violence. He went down to the Houses of Parliament to arrest five of his most active opponents. He entered the House of Commons and took the Speaker's chair. He was prepared with some bold speech about treason, but when he saw the places of his five antagonists vacant, he was baffled, confused, and spoke in broken sentences. He learnt that they had departed from his royal city of Westminster and taken refuge in the city of London. London defied him. A week later, the five members were escorted back in triumph to the Parliament House in Westminster by the trained bands of London, and the king, to avoid the noise and hostility of the occasion, left Whitehall for Windsor. Both parties then prepared openly for war. The king was the traditional head of the army, and the habit of obedience in soldiers is to the king. The Parliament had the greater resources. The king set up his standard at Nottingham on the eve of a dark and stormy August day in 1642. There followed a long and obstinate civil war, the king holding Oxford, the Parliament London. Success swayed from side to side, but the king could never close on London nor Parliament take Oxford. Each antagonist was weakened by moderate adherents who didn't want to go too far. There emerged among the parliamentary commanders a certain Oliver Cromwell, who had raised a small troop of horse and who rose to the position of general. Lord Warwick, his contemporary, describes him as a plain man in a cloth suit made by an ill country tailor. He was no mere fighting soldier, but a military organizer. He realized the inferior quality of many of the parliamentary forces and set himself to remedy it. The cavaliers of the king had the picturesque tradition of chivalry and loyalty on their side. Parliament was something new and difficult, without any comparable tradition. "Your troops are most of them old, decayed serving-men and tapsters," said Cromwell. "Do you think that the spirits of such base and mean fellows will ever be able to encounter gentlemen that have honour and courage and resolution in them?" But there's something better and stronger than picturesque chivalry in the world, religious enthusiasm. He set himself to get together a godly regiment. They were to be earnest, sober-living men. Above all, they were to be men of strong convictions. He disregarded all social traditions and drew his officers from every class. "I had rather have a plain, russet-coated captain that knows what he fights for and loves what he knows, than what you call a gentleman and is nothing else." England discovered a new force, the Ironsides, in its midst, in which footmen, draymen, and ship's captains held high command, side by side with men of family. They became the type on which the Parliament sought to reconstruct its entire army. The Ironsides were the backbone of this new model. From Marston Moor to Naseby, these men swept the cavaliers before them. The king was at last a captive in the hands of Parliament. There were still attempts at settlement that would have left the king a sort of king, but Charles was a man doomed to tragic issues, incessantly scheming, so false a man that he's not to be trusted. The English were drifting towards a situation new in the world's history, in which a monarch should be formally tried for treason to his people and condemned. Most revolutions are precipitated, as this English one was, by the excesses of the ruler, and by attempts at strength and firmness beyond the compass of the law. And most revolutions swing by a kind of necessity towards an extremer conclusion than is warranted by the original quarrel. The English Revolution was no exception. The English are by nature a compromising and even a vacillating people, and probably the great majority of them still wanted the king to be king, and the people to be free, and all the lions and lambs to lie down together in peace and liberty. But the army of the new model couldn't go back. There would have been scant mercy for these draymen and footmen who had ridden down the king's gentlemen if the king came back. When Parliament began to treat again with this regal trickster, the new model intervened. Colonel Pride turned out 80 members from the House of Commons who favoured the king, and the illegal residue, the Rump Parliament, then put the king on trial. But indeed the king was already doomed. The House of Lords rejected the ordinance for the trial, and the Rump then proclaimed that the people are, under God, the original of all just power, and that the Commons of England have the supreme power in this nation, and, assuming that it was itself the Commons, proceeded with the trial.